Ladies and gentlemen, this is the 10K Collective Podcast, and I am Michael Veazey, your host. And today I'm going to introduce a couple more of our The E-Commerce Leader special guest episodes. And the reason I'm happy to weave these into the mix, we will be getting back to a lot of expert interviews on the specialist sort of e-commerce and specifically Amazon type subjects. But these couple of episodes I'm going to introduce now, quite big picture stuff, but really critical. It's part of what Jason Miles, my co-host on the E-Commerce Leader, calls profit strategy. And that's obviously, it does what it says on the tin. How do you get profit? But one of the parts of that is the business model, the invisible hand of the business model, as Seth Godin puts it. And we've talked before about the scalability and evaluating a business model overall. And today and in the next episode, we're going to talk about defensibility, how robust your business model is. And that is never been a more important question than right now when I'm recording this in September 2020 with COVID having raged and probably due to rage again. Defensibility is absolutely up there as a characteristic of your business. So we're going to cover what we call the seven moats of defensibility, including things like a near monopolistic characteristics, a big thing that Warren Buffett, the most famous investor ever, probably looks for. And we're going to talk about various different things like an indefensible market and why it's so bad, why a two or three times markup means your business is dead in the water before it starts, and McDonald's secret brand positioning statement and what that can mean for you as an e-commerce seller. So stay tuned. If you like what you're hearing, then do go and listen to The E-Commerce Leader. Go and subscribe to that on the podcast app of your choice. And of course, if you really like it, please don't forget to give us a rating on Apple Podcasts if you're an Apple Podcast user. Thanks for listening. We are Michael Veazey in London, England.
Jason Miles in Seattle, Washington.
More importantly, you are the owner of a thriving online business and you want to become the best e-commerce leader you can be. We're here to get you there. For show notes with links and resources mentioned today, and for other juicy resources like downloads and free mini courses, just visit our blog, theecommerceleader.com.
Michael, today we're talking about the seven moats of defensibility. You ready to jump into this?
I'm ready to jump into the moat, but as long as you explain what that means.
All right, well, let's do it. Let's dig into this. So this is going to be a fun conversation. We're going to go into a little bit of a framework dialogue and talk about a model that I like to share with people. And the seven moats of defensibility, what we mean by that is you want to build a business that has layers of protection around it so that your economic interests, your business profitability, and all the aspects of your business can really be defended from competition and from ruin. And so that's what I mean by it. That's the topic of the day.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to translate that into a nice little British metaphor here. So I like the castle's idea. So I want you to imagine a castle, which is your business, and you've got a moat around it with water that's filled with crocodiles, another walled moat around it that's filled with sharks, then another that's filled with piranhas, another one that's filled with giant anacondas. Well, you get the idea. You've got seven moats, seven layers of defensibility between your castle and the outside world. So why should you bother having all these moats? Well, on the other side of the moats is an angry mob of raiders that is set to take your opportunity, kill you, burn it to the ground, and run off with your treasure. Mm. So if your family and livelihood and your income all depend on the moats, you really want to think about them hard and work to improve them over time. And by the way, acknowledgement for that to Mr. Jason Miles. So obviously you came up with this cool metaphor, which I know you're very into metaphors. How did you come up with this idea?
Well, thank you for reading my little story there. That was really cool. That sounded terrific. Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I heard, of course, Warren Buffett talk about the castles with unbreachable moats idea. And many, many people have heard that. Of course, he's famous for creating that phrase. And I love the idea of it. And so if you're not familiar with that, let me just read a little tiny paragraph here from one of his annual letters where he describes this idea, you know, straight from the horse's mouth, if you would. But here's the paragraph. The dynamics of capitalism guarantee that competitors will repeatedly assault any business castle that's earning high returns. Therefore, a formidable barrier, such as a company's being the low-cost producer, Geico or Costco, or possessing a powerful worldwide brand, Coca-Cola, Gillette, American Express, is essential for sustained success. History is filled with Roman candles, companies whose moats proved illusory and were soon crossed. And man, when I read that, I was just like, oh my gosh, I want a business that has a castle and, of course, and a moat. And I want like a bunch of moats. And he mentions a couple there. And it really spurred the thinking of, you know, I mean, how do you build a business that has a really, really strong set of defenses so that you can sustain yourself for, you know, years, decades,
yeah, long term? Yeah. I love that. And what I think is interesting about that quote, I'm familiar with the concept, but I hadn't heard the exact quote read out. And there's something very powerful about that, because the idea of Roman candles. So I know there's a firework that goes absolutely massive for a while and then dies pretty swiftly. And actually on the online world, including Amazon, in my experience, that's incredibly common. So therefore, he's put his finger on something very real about this industry, right? E-commerce and internet marketing in general. So look, I presume those moats don't actually consist of piranhas and sharks and anacondas, though it sounds really cool, not very practical to build a business with those things. So what are the actual seven moats that you've come up with?
Yeah, let me just read the list. And I'll say before I read it that this is my list that I've come up with, but it's not exhaustive, I don't think. I think each of us could brainstorm for our own business. What are, you know, layers of defensibility? And so, you know, as with the Nine Mountains, I think, is a framework that we talk about for traffic that is in concrete in my mind. There are only nine mountains of traffic. But with defensibility, with the seven moats, you know, you could have 10, 15, 20 things on the list. So let me read the seven and we'll go from there. The first, a profitable in-demand product with near monopolistic characteristics. The second, high functioning brand that's powerful at attracting the right people. The third is a community or a tribe of loyal followers. The fourth is channel dominance and mastery. The fifth is data specific, for example, email lists or traffic. The sixth is high switching costs built into your model. And the seventh is a culture of innovation. So there they are. There are the seven that I've put together that I've tried to implement into my business. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So those do sound extremely attractive things. So the first question then, let's discuss them one at a time. The first question is the monopoly. I mean, it sounds really powerful. It's obviously very valuable. So how do we get even close to a monopoly in an e-commerce business?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a few different ways. I mean, that when you start to ponder that idea, there are a few things that come to mind. Obviously, if you're an artist, you're creating one-off pieces, you have a monopoly on your own creations. If you're a writer, you have that. If you're a course creator, although topically you don't, but for the specific content you share, you do. But those are not, you know, product-focused strategies. So for the product-focused strategy people, the simplest one that comes to my mind is like an exclusive with a manufacturer or, you know, license to sell in the United States. We have coaching clients that have that arrangement with manufacturers where they found the opportunity to work as the exclusive United States seller. And it really creates a powerful barrier around their model. I don't know if in your 10K collective group, if there are any folks that operate that way with exclusives or licenses, but it can be very, very powerful.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's somebody in that group who has indeed got a license with a very large manufacturer in the toy space, shall we say, without giving any names away. And yeah, that's really powerful. So he's creating private label products, but with a license from those people. And one of the really important things to point out about licensing very briefly, and this will be a topic to deep dive into, as a lawyer, Robert Wright was saying to me the other day, I interviewed for the Amazing FBA podcast, that it's one thing to get intellectual property rights. It's a whole other thing, again, to enforce them. Just like creating law is one thing, law enforcement is another. Yeah. The wonderful thing about partnering with a really powerful entity of some kind is that they have got lawyers and legal, you know, assistants, what have you, that scour the internet for intellectual property violations and come down really hard, and they have the budget to enforce it. So you've just allied yourself with, you know, somebody who can actually deal with the reinforcement of your exclusivity. So I think there's a lot in that.
I've never thought of it that way, but you're totally right. I've been on the wrong end of that kind of situation.
Yeah, exactly. But, we've all been on the wrong end of those, right? I mean, I certainly have. I mean, you know, not frequently, but I've had Getty Images get in touch, for example, when I used one of their images very foolishly a while ago. And it just struck me, wow, if I were the person on the other side of that equation, partners with them. you've got Big Brother in the house, you know.
You got a moat. They've got a moat. You're the raider, and you realize real fast the power of the defensibility of that model. Yeah, so that's near monopolistic characteristics that we want to strive for. Yeah.
Great. Are there any other ways that you can think of, with just very briefly, on the other monopolistic characteristics that you can get? So an exclusive, a license, any other ways?
Well, I mean, there are industries that lean towards winner-take-all situations. And sometimes the internet does this for you. I mean, sometimes the internet Google will do this in a way for you. I mean, if you're in the top 1, 2, or 3 search results for Google, you have a near monopolistic characteristic of the traffic that's coming in. So, I mean, there are ways to look at this, I suppose. Licensing is the simplest one to think through for product or original creation of a product that you then enforce with your own intellectual property rights. And that is, to your point, you got some expense to it with lawyering up and stuff like that. But there are clients that we have, and even a business partner, Kyle, on the coaching business, he's done very, very well by having original concepts he's put together. He's even done original concepts. Think about this. He has a product that's generic, quasi-generic. It's a private label product. But he got a design trademark on his, or a design protection on his packaging. So his packaging has defensibility, even though the product doesn't. And so in a really interesting way, he's created a layer of defensibility with just even protection of the packaging concept, which is a very interesting and unique idea, but wasn't hard for him to do. He just had to think it through. And so that, you know, those types of ideas go into it. Yeah.
So one thing that's obviously we've touched on there, which I'd like to dig into how these things connect a little bit without confusing ourselves, because this is just the overview where we're going to deep dive into this. But you mentioned channel dominance as an extension of monopoly. Yeah. But I'm presuming that's actually kind of a separate thing, as you put it yourself, as a separate thing. Channel dominance. You mentioned that Google dominance thing, for example. If you're in the top 2-3 results, it kind of gives you quasi a monopolistic thing. But you're also saying, is that kind of what you meant by channel dominance?
I guess so. I mean, yeah. Think about it in your 10K collective. How does that impact your, you have a collective group of a lot of successful Amazon sellers. Is that play into their success at all? Having that, Amazon's choice, getting in the buy box, having the number one search result, the most reviews, all of that. Does that help sustain their business, and is it a part of their success?
Absolutely. Yes. I would say, out of all the things you've mentioned, I mean, I've mentioned also one person with the licensing deal. That's a very powerful sort of quasi monopoly. The other guys haven't got a monopoly at all. They're in very competitive arenas in some cases, but the most successful business by far in terms of revenue and revenue growth. And he's been with us, the owner of the business, been in the groups for a couple of years, 2.5 years now. So it's been quite consistent. It is that they, for a lot of the main keywords for the products, they dominate position 1, 2, and 4 of the top of Amazon search results. And probably similar to Google, I don't know the click attribution sort of percentages, but I know that something like 75% of all Google clicks come from the top three positions organically. And I don't know how true that is for Amazon, but it's got to be quite close. So it can be an exponential change between being position 6 for a keyword and position 1.
That's right.
So yeah, it for sure it's real. Yeah. Very, very, very real. Mm-hmm.
And it's it creates a self-fulfilling success prophecy, or I guess you could call it a virtual spiral, where because you're ranked number one, you get the most reviews, and the most reviews then just reinforce you get the most sales, and the algorithms really bake in. I mean, they kind of cook you into the top slot if you're lucky enough to get it in many of the platforms. And I'm lucky on Udemy to have that occur, for one of my courses. And when that happens, it's magic. I mean, it feels like, wow, I've got somebody helping me here,
Yeah, I think you've made a very good point. And one other tiny point on that before we move on is that there is a lot more stability in sales volume at the top of page one, because you don't keep changing rank. You have a consistent rank, which means you are selling quite a consistent percentage of that market. What changes a bit over time is either demand or sometimes supply issues or Amazon can't fulfill, like we've had in the COVID crisis. But it's a lot less variable than bopping between position 10 and position 6 or something. So there's another bonus as well. So let's come to the, you mentioned the branding thing already with, you know, the infamous private label, so-called, whatever that means exactly, and branding the packaging. So what's the importance of the branding? And I know you talked several times already in our conversations about the word high-functioning brand. What do you mean by that, and why is it so important in sort of dominating and creating a moat?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think for Amazon sellers in particular that have been exposed to the idea of private label product strategies, they're not given a lot of training, at least in my experience, as I've, you know, kind of gone through the process a few times, they're not given a lot of training on the real deep meaning behind brand creation and the power of what goes into a real brand, a authority brand. I mean, you can use any phrase you want, but an effective brand that has what you might call emotive qualities. The best model I know of that for working through that idea is James Bergen and John Ward created this model or used this model called the iceberg metaphor, where they talk about the visible aspects, like an iceberg floating out in the ocean, where there's visible above the waterline aspects. And that would be the name and the logo and the tagline and the colors. And then they talk about what's below the waterline, the invisible aspects, which would include the promise, the deep meaning, the elements that aren't necessarily visible to the outside observer, but the aficionados, the real followers, the customers, those are the things they end up valuing, you know. And I think that's a really powerful thing to build into your model. That's what Warren Buffett was talking about in that quote, you know, for Coca-Cola, you know, the other businesses that he's over time valued and you know, tried to invest in were ones that had an absolutely crushingly dominant brand.
Yeah.
If we're going to make a product, private label product, that's on us. You know, we got to learn to do that stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the idea. So.
Absolutely. And one thing that I think you've put your finger on, I've gone through this process with you in the past when you're coaching clients, and it's really powerful because I take all of my clients through this stuff now, I'm afraid. I guess most John Bergen's passed it to you, he's passed it to me. And I think the idea that you have a very strong awareness of who your customer is, the values they have, the values you have as a brand. None of that is about get a logo and get nice looking packaging. I mean, obviously you've got to do those things, but they need to represent those, as you call it, the invisible parts of the values, which I think is very powerful. I just want to trust on one example of that for the corporate world, which I think is very powerful, that somebody leaked a document from McDonald's which had on it the promise, the ultimate brand promise, that was that they would be their trusted friend. And they did also say in that nobody was ever to use that exact phrase. Now, I know you've got some thoughts on why they would do that as well. What do you think was behind that?
So on the document that was leaked, it said, do not use this phrase.
Exactly. You were never to actually say McDonald's is your trusted friend. So what do you think's going on with that?
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Well, so I guess they were following, just if we use the iceberg framework, they were saying below the waterline, our mantra, our ethos, our goal is to be the trusted friend. But above the waterline, that's not the terminology we use. I mean, that's exactly what they were saying. Do not use these phrases or this term, but build a brand that expresses that ethos.
Yeah.
And many famous brand owners, if you ask them about the ethos or what's behind it. You know, I remember Howard Schultz talking about Starbucks creation, and it's a local company here, and Pike Place is the first location, and everybody who comes to Seattle goes there. He talks about going to Italy and seeing the power of a cafe environment and that third place where people would congregate. And that was the deep meaning that he wanted to install. It's not about the coffee, really. It's about the community. It kind of gets to our next point, I guess, if I could ask you the question about the next point, which is a community or a tribe of loyalists is the other thing that I have on the list. Tribe of loyalists or a community. Do you have any examples that come to mind in terms of 10K Collective, or how have you seen that play out in terms of business or in your area of expertise?
Yeah, two examples. I mean, one is in the 10K Collective Masterminds, where one of the groups, one of the people in the group has got a Facebook group that they use in a very interesting way without revealing too much, but it's broadly speaking a sort of brand loyalty program. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's worked really well for them in terms of increasing their review percentages quite a lot. I mean, that's really been mm-hmm. powerful. It's not a short-term hack to get more sales. It's, I guess, the driver of it and the mechanics on Amazon would be reviews, but I think it's actually even bigger than they thought originally. I think they were just doing that with the Amazon hat on, and they quickly realized there's a lot more power in it. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that you and I both have communities of people on Facebook mm-hmm. and what have you. And I think, yeah, that the power of a community that I've seen the most powerful, to be honest, is a very small group of people in the masterminds, actually much more powerful in terms yeah. of producing revenue for my business, but also helping the members than right. giant Facebook groups. So it's not always about size is the one thing I would say about yeah. community as well. It's about engagement, I think.
Well, that's what I really have appreciated about your model, is that you built your, you know, business model around the idea of bringing successful sellers together locally, which is so cool. I mean, that's the neat part to me, is that you guys meet up locally, you have it, you know, kind of a formal process, and you're the convener, you're the conductor, the orchestra leader there. And that's really, really cool. So that level of community, I think, is powerful. And yeah.
I think so. And one of the things about it, of course, now we're having to move online. But I mean, there are online communities you can build, and the Facebook group is a model for that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you guys have got a pretty good thing going with your membership program, and you've got Sewing with Cinnamon. Tell me about that.
Well, yeah. So, you know, we were working on our business a few years ago. I'll tell you, just as if we have time, I'll tell you a quick story. We had a set of physical products that we started selling, and I was using this concept called Be the Most Complete Provider, which we can talk about at some point. And I started selling a bunch of physical products. And after 2 years, we realized we really hated selling physical products. And so, but it was a six-figure revenue line, and not much profit on the six-figure revenue line, but it was six-figure revenue line. So we wanted to kill it. And we were like, man, that's a lot of money to just stop. So what could we do as an alternate to that? And so I had heard about membership, you know, monthly recurring membership models. I saw the kind of guru or expert on that is Stu McLaren, give all the credit to him. I went through his course, and we launched a Sewing with Cinnamon membership site. It's a monthly recurring membership. People have paid, you know, between $9 and $14, basically, depending on how they buy into it monthly. And we have about 1,000 people in it, and it is all digitally delivered content. And it has become a real meaningful part of our business. And I'm a huge believer in building community and tribe, and that there's a lot of lessons to be learned there, but it can be a really, really powerful defensive mechanism as well in your business. You've got a tribe of loyalists, you've got a level of defense against competition. You know?
Really interesting. And what I think we both talked about is paid versions of that. And I think there's often an assumption that it's all about part A is a huge marketing thing, like a Facebook community, Instagram followers, Twitter followers, whatever it is, YouTube subscribers. And then part B is you monetize that by selling them products. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting about your model is that you monetize it as the membership, and then presumably you monetize it again by selling those people digital products as well through, you know, the doll design stuff.
We absolutely do. And I'm very happy to be open-handed about how we do that process. In fact, we have a couple layers of how we do that, but you're right. It's a stacked product on top of our one-off digital sales, on top of one-off online course sales. So yeah, it weaves together nicely. And there's a real powerful opportunity there for physical product sellers and Amazon sellers who want to migrate off of, you know, or beyond Amazon, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's got to be a real deep dive, at least one or two episodes on that, because mm-hmm. the monthly recurring revenue thing obviously has huge cash flow stability mm-hmm. advantages, less stressful. But we could let's not get into the weeds about that today, but that's one to definitely discuss for future.
That was the E-Commerce Leader podcast with Michael Veazey in London, England.
And Jason Miles in Seattle, Washington.
We offer you free help on our website, including PDFs, videos, and mini courses on topics like traffic, product, and sales channels. Some are for Amazon, most are for any sales channel. To get those and to stay up to date with our podcasts, go to www.theecommerceleader.com. Thanks for listening.